Charlie WB 2EAV.
You're going to tell me you have one of those hydrometers sitting in your garage?
True, but that's not where I'm going. No, cars have gone to lead calcium batteries, which do not need all of that. True. However, that does not mean they're gone forever. I am at work looking into a battery backup system for a solar array. And everybody says, if you don't mind doing a little bit of maintenance, the cheapest way to go is so-called flooded, deep cycle lead acid, which is basically the old-fashioned lead acid batteries with the hydrometers. So they're not dead and forgotten.
Okay, good. Okay, that's, I think I may do an Andy's Corner on batteries in the future. It's a good topic. There's a lot to talk about because there's so many different batteries out there, all different types. So that's something that may be, I'm going to look into. All right, thanks, Ed. Let me just let it drop, and I'm going to start. Okay, very good. So it's 9 o'clock, just after 9. Well, just 9 o'clock. So I got to go to work tomorrow, so I got to see if I can get through this. I got one page. Where do we leave off? Transmission line stubs. I got a page and a half to talk about. We'll see. So welcome to Andy's Corner. And for people listening to this, these discussions we've been having the past number of weeks, I know it's been drawn out week after week with stuff leading up to impedance matching with transmission lines, but I had to basically, convey the information to people interested, hopefully people are interested on transmission line transformers, which is what this stuff is, which is what this article is about in QST, going back to November 2019, and it's an article by Ward Silver, N0AX, and it's using transmission lines to convert impedances, but I had to talk about, what is a transmission line, what kind of transmission line. In this case, it's coax cable, and what are the characteristics of coax cables, how do they work, and so on. So I was talking about that in the past. So the last discussion, the last week I was talking about, this article talking about feed lines and impedances, going into that a little bit. And then we spoke about synchronous transformers using quarter wave matching section of transmission line to match one impedance to another. And they call it a Q section. So that's the most common example, is the quarter wave of Q section, which is a quarter wavelength long. Quarter wavelength, by the way, in degrees is 90 degrees. If you look at a circle, quarter wave is 90 degrees, half wave is 180 degrees, and so on, then 270 and 360. So, and there's a formula which I mentioned, which uses, so the most common example is a quarter wave or Q section, which uses a quarter wavelength or a feed line with an impedance, and there's a formula which is basically the square root of the impedance of the load times the impedance of the source. So it's, Z load times Z in, ZB being the impedance, and you take...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that famous timeout. Yeah, sorry, let me wait to CDO. Let me let it drop again. Okay, so I just mentioned the formula that's used. So, these articles, you have to use some visualization to really see what's going on. And unfortunately, that's, can't visualize too easily without actually seeing, what's happening. There's plenty of YouTube videos on this stuff, too. So, I left off talking about synchronous transformers, which is what this is, the most common use of transmission lines in impedance matching are the synchronous transformers, or what they call synchronous transformers, which is special lengths of feed line connected in series between an impedance to be matched at one end of the line, which is the load, Z load, impedance of the load, and the desired impedance of the at the other end, which is Z in, which is the source. So you want to match the source to the load. They call it a synchronous transformer. And the synchronous, it means the reflections generated at the connections of the feed line synchronize or add together to create the desired impedance at the input to the matching section. And they have a picture here of showing different line lengths of transmission lines of, you know, coax cables to match one impedance at one end to one impedance at the other end. So it's a good way of doing things. The only losses you have are the coax cables themselves, because all coax cables have losses to some degree. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so I spoke about that. And they use an example of converting an impedance of 100 ohms to an impedance, a 50 ohm source to a 100 ohm load, or vice versa. And you put it into the formula and you get, it comes out to 70.7 ohms, which in this case you could use RG59, RG11, or 75 ohm hardline, which matches that, or is close to that 70.7 ohm answer to the to the equation that that's given. All right, let me just let it drop. Okay, so I mentioned that as I mentioned earlier, last week, the reflections either add or they add together, that and the reflections are caused by a VSWR that's created because of a mismatch. So one set of reflections is created at the connection at the Q section to the antennas. They're using the antenna as an example, at the feed point, and the other set at the connection to the 50 ohm feed line that's feeding it. The reflections all add together such that the antenna feed point is connected where the impedance is 100 ohms and the main 50 ohm feed line is connected at a 50 ohm impedance point. Any anti-reflection coatings, now they're talking about the lenses, which we mentioned last week. There's an anti-reflection coating on lenses use the same principle of a quarter wave coating to cancel reflections that causes glare. We spoke about that a little bit last week. A little bit of drop. Okay. Again, I don't like the way the wording is in this QST article, so I'm just reading it from there. So, in regard to saying that, I'm just giving an overview for anybody who's interested. Synchronous transformers depend on the electrical length of the feed line being a particular fraction of a wavelength long. Okay, now, what's important to know is these are single-band transformers, so they're not broadbanded. Unlike broadbanded ferrite transformers, for example, the greater the difference between the two impedances, the narrower the bandwidth of the match will be. Nevertheless, performance is generally accepted over a single amateur band. So, you know, it's basically, it's not a broadband device. It's used at on a single band. The transformer section and the impedance of the load can vary actually up to 10% or so and still give acceptable results. So you got just enough to be so accurate to get the impedance match. So, all right, that basically is where I ended last week. So now I'm going to continue, and we're going to talk about something different called transmission line stubs. So we'll get into that discussion. Let me let it drop. All right, does anybody have any questions up to this point so far before I go into the stub matching? Okay, it's quiet out there. All right, so again, this is from the article, transmission line stubs. So impedance transformers made from feed line don't have to be in series with another feed line to work. They can also be connected in parallel. Okay, so up to this point, we're talking about two pieces of coax cable in series with each other. So now we're talking about something in parallel. The most common transformer of this sort is called a stub. And everybody's heard of stub tuning. Because stubs, you know, have interesting properties at the fundamental and the harmonics, the second harmonic, the third harmonic, and so on. And that's because of the characteristic of how it works. And it goes back to an earlier discussion that I spoke about when you take a piece of cable at a certain length and you short it or open it, and it becomes either a parallel resonant circuit or a series resonant circuit or a capacitor or an inductor or something in between. So they use that to match impedances. And this is what the stub is, and it's called a stub because it's a length of coax that's connected in parallel, and it's either shorted or open, or has some other resistance at one end that would cause some reflected wave to either add or subtract to the original wave, and they have a little pictorial of this. It causes a phase shift, and the phase shifts either add or subtract from each other, and if they do, they cancel, and so on. So that's basically an overview of what a stub does, and I'm just saying that. Now, the article says, stubs can be connected in parallel. The most common transformer of this sort is called a stub. The name comes from the short length of feed line. That's what it is. It's a short length of feed line. Like the in-series transformers, the stub creates a reflected wave that combines with the waves in the main feed line to change the impedance at that point. So, again, if you visualize, you have a reflected wave coming back from the stub, and it's going to combine with the main waves coming from the source, and that's going to cause a mismatch or a change in impedance right there, at that point. So that's basically...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Push. Okay, Wesley, I heard you had a question. Go ahead.
Wouldn't the reflected signal be out of phase, 180 degrees? You use the word combine.
Yeah, it shows here, there's a picture of this where the waves divide equally. The waves will divide equally between the, because of the phase shift at the end of the stub. This is a shorted stub, by the way. So there's a short piece of coax cable that's shorted. So as the reflected wave comes back, and because it's a quarter wave, it's just the opposite at the other end. It's every quarter wave, the impedance inverts. you know, there's an inversion. So if you have a high impedance at one end, it's a low impedance at the other end. And, yeah, and they combine. So, let me see. I got about 10, 15 minutes left because I have to go to work tomorrow. In the series, let's see, the stub creates a reflected wave that combines with the waves in the main feed line to change the impedance. I just read that. The electrical length of the stub. Okay. And the stub. Okay, let me just do this one more time because I'm just reading too fast. So I'll repeat that. Like this in-series transformers, the stub creates a reflected wave, which combines with the waves in the main feed line to change the impedance at that point. The electrical length of the stub, the termination at the far end of the stub, and the stub's impedance control the amplitude and the phase of the reflected wave. Okay, so obviously the stub has to be a certain length. And what kind of termination is at the end of it? Could be open, shorted, or something in between. Some resistor. Okay, so they give you a little analogy here. Returning to a mechanical analogy, and maybe this is easier for people to see. Let me let it drop. Using a stub to match an impedance is very similar to adding a weight on a tire's rim to balance a wheel. By itself, the wheel's imbalance sets up a vibration in the axle. The weight, or weights, added to the rim set up their own vibrations that are just the right size and timing to cancel the vibrations of the wheel when they add together in the axle. Yeah, and I see that's interesting. You know, when they put that little weight on your rim, you've seen that before. There's a machine that actually tells you exactly where that weight's supposed to go, so they know exactly where it is. They spin the wheel, it measures the vibrations, and points to, okay, add a weight of a certain weight. Usually I think it's a piece of lead, because lead is pretty heavy. It's a little lead weight. Add that to the rim, and now your wheel is balanced. So that's the analogy that they use. Let me let it drop. Okay, so it is possible to use a single stub that is a quarter wavelength long or less to match any impedance in a feed line to the desired impedance at a single frequency. Obviously, it's frequency dependent, so you got to be, you know, you got to know the frequency you want to do this. And by the way, they're referring to, there's a number of articles on the internet here. If anybody wants to see any of this stuff, because I was looking it over, it's pretty good. There's a free transmission line design tool. It's called SIM Smith, like Smith chart. SIM Smith, okay, is a free transmission line. You can write this down. Maybe while you're writing it, or you want to look it up. It's a free transmission line system design tool available online, and you could just do a Google search and it'll come right up, and you could see it. There's a YouTube video on it that talks about transmission line impedances, like I'm talking, and how to use a Smith chart. How the Smith chart works. Very, very good article. So, boy, let me just give it over to you if you want to acknowledge that. If you want to write that down, I looked at it. It's a very good article. It's called SIM, S-I-M, Smith, S-I-M-I-T-H.
Yeah, I'm doing it as you speak. By the time you finish your next paragraph, it should be available on the link page.
Okay, very good. So, he's referring to this. All right, so he also says, getting back to the article, the impedance to be matched cannot be a pure reactance a short or an open circuit, and you also have to be able to connect the stub at just the right point in the feed line. All right, so there are many different arrangements and methods of using stubs. There's also, he's referring to software. There's a TLW software by Richard Straw, N6BV, and as I just mentioned, and SimSmith by Edward Harriman, AE6TY, to calculate the exact electrical lengths as well as experiment with different arrangements of stubs and series sections of feed lines. So, if you look at these videos that I'm mentioning, it'll actually show you what it looks like. Because I'm just talking about it, but you'll actually see it. And these are YouTube videos these guys have. So it's SimSmith, and the other one is TLW. That's Thomas Lee Lima Whiskey by Richard Straw, N6 Baker, Violet, Violin, BV. All right, so that refers to that. Let me let it drop. Okay. So, actually, I think I'm going to end not too long, because it's already almost 9:30. The next section is going to be just on antenna feed point matching, you know, getting into antennas. And it's just a small little section. Actually, it's a page. It's not a page. But I think I'm going to hold off on that. I'll make that next week, since we're talking about stubs. So stubs can also act as bandpass or notch filters. For example, a shorted stub, so that means it's terminated in a short circuit. So you take the stub and you short out the end of the coax. You take the center conductor and you short it to the shield. That's a shorted stub. You make it a quarter wavelength long at the frequency of the frequency F, and that'll present an open circuit which is a quarter wavelength away because it inverts the impedance. So you have a short at one end and you're going to have an open circuit at the other end. And they show you in a figure. So that'll be at the opposite end of the stub. Now, you can take that stub and that becomes a half wavelength long at twice the frequency. So if you put a frequency into that, whatever frequency that you're designing the quarter wave stub for, now you're going to take that frequency, you're going to double it. You're going to go twice the frequency. Now it's going to have a different property. So the other figure shows the stub becomes a half wavelength long at the second, at twice the frequency. So now it prevents a short circuit at that frequency at the opposite end. Because again, now you're inverting your impedances again. Every half wavelength, another half wave from a quarter wave, you're going to invert it back. So you can use a shorted stub that is a quarter wavelength long on 40 meters to short out or cancel a second harmonic on 20 meters. Okay, and that's important to know. So if you want to make a harmonic filter, that's the way to do it. Okay? Let it drop. All right. Stubs of this type are frequently used for reducing harmonics in multi-transmitter stations. Field day is a good example because you got multiple transmitters transmitting at the same time on different frequencies with different antennas. So ARRL field day setups use this. There is a field day stub filter project that's described in Note 3 and is also in the ARRL antenna handbook. And Note 3 is hands-on radio talking about stubs. And that's an ARRL publication, ARRL.org/hands-on-radio. talks about stub matching. You could do a Google search for that too. You know, using stub matching. You could do a Google ARRL stub matching. It'll come up. I haven't seen that one, but it sounds good. Okay, so many stub applications can be found in George Custer, George's W2VJN, Excellent Measuring Installation. Oh, it's called Excellent Managing Installation Interference. Okay. Excellent Managing Installation Interference, which is referred to number 8, and this number 8 here is, the article is called Managing Station Interference. And that's also www.inrad.net. You can find that on the internet also. Managing installation interference. So, again, so there's an example. I just gave everybody an example of how a stub could be used as a harmonic filter for canceling or matching an impedance. Now we're going to talk about the next page, which I guess is 930 now, so I'm going to just hold off, is your antenna feed point matching. And they talk about the gamma match and the beta or hairpin match, and then some references. So I'm going to end it here right now because I do have to get ready for work tomorrow. I hope everybody enjoyed a little bit of this discussion. Get a little bit of more insight to stubs and where they're used and how they're used, and so on, as far as synchronous transmission transformers, impedance matching using quarter wave matching sections, and so on. So I appreciate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, W2CDL, repeater, timeout, cancel is good. So that's it for now. I just wanted to thank everyone for listening again, and hope I didn't put too many people to sleep with my Andy's Corner. Roy, back to you. Sorry, I have to go a little bit quicker today because I do have some work stuff I got to take care of. AC2GS, W2CDL. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS, no problem, Andy. Thank you very much for Andy's Corner. Hopefully, I guess next Sunday, we'll get the second half of that article. So I'm looking forward to it. And thanks a great deal for participating in our technical net.
Yep, we'll continue. Take care.
Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's here every Sunday night at 8 p.m. So once again, if anyone has come up with any interesting either questions or topics or technical statements that they'd like to discuss, this is a good time and a place. Please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign.
K2GJE, we have some free time, over.
Well, yeah, I mean, just as we usually do, if you have any topic you would like to bounce around or comments you'd like to make, as long as they're scientific, sure.
K2GJE, I heard about a new network that they're testing that uses photons. And they have it running, I think, something like from Buffalo through Ithaca, where Cornell University is, to out here on Long Island to Brookhaven. Have you heard anything about it, over?
No, nothing specific. It sounds as though it's some iteration of a fiber optical transmission line, or am I missing something?
I don't know if they send it over fiber optic or some new kind of cable. Supposedly, the big thing is that it is secure, that if someone tries to tap into it and remove the photon, you will know right away. Over.
Okay, I mean, that's interesting. That sounds a heck of a lot like quantum encryption. The concept is to entangle signals such that they can only be decoded once. The act of trying to decode them in the middle, you know, the person in the middle attack is what they usually call that for present-day Internet. But quantum transmission lines have this interesting quality if they can get them stable and running sufficiently with the right bit rate, that they only allow for one end-to-end transmission. You can't kind of sneak in through it. So I think you might be talking about some quantum photonic type of transmission. The Chinese were testing that type of technology out with its recent satellites last year, I understand.
That's all I heard about it, and now you've supplied a little more information. Is it going over fiber optic? Over.
It can go through fiber optic. It can go through space if you want. Any transmission line that allows for the transmission of a stream of photons is capable of utilizing it. I think for the most part, especially ground-based, it's going to end up being some form of optical cable because that's just the easiest way to manage such things. But I think the satellite was transmitting just through the ether, if you will.
I heard this is over land, so definitely it must be going on a good quality fiber optic cable. I just heard or read it someplace, and I was looking for more information. Over.
Okay, I mean, it's a fascinating subject. There seems to be technical limitations. They might have gotten around them in that you have to sustain the entanglement and you have to kind of raise the bandwidth because, you know, it's all well and good to be secure, but you want a certain data symbol rate in order to get the data enough information through the pipeline. So maybe they've come up with the solutions to those problems as well. As I mentioned, the Chinese were working on it in open space in their satellites. So I guess our guys are working on it as well. I have to go back to Google and see if there's anything new on the horizon. I usually check the technological publications, but I haven't seen anything, but I could have missed it.
US2N.
Yes, Paul.
I remember covering that on the net, and they talked about China going from city to city, and if that worked out, they were going to do it from space, put a satellite up there, and see if it would be able to transmit down to a city, and they were successful in doing that. So you're right; they have been doing it. I don't know what the data rate is, though. I don't know how successful that is, but I know they accomplish it, you know, from one area to another area in China, and then from that I'm not sure if it was Beijing, but you know, one of the cities to the satellite and back down to the ground somewhere else. I seem to remember they teamed up with Germany, I think it went from Germany to the satellite to back to a city in China. Back to you.
Yeah, I read those articles, and the problem is that the nitty-gritty details are probably military secrets because, you know, it's a big thing of how sustainable you can get these things. You can, you know, as I mentioned years ago on this technical net when Dick was discussing quantum entanglement, you can show wonderful experiments that demonstrate quantum entanglement in a college lecture hall. They're not special. The problem with entanglement is the stability. They can fall apart any old second, and you can only have so many entangled pairs at one time. So that's the big thing. This is a topic called quantum encryption. And if they're able to do it, it's a fascinating thing because, as far as I'm aware, there's no getting around the impossibility of tapping that signal. It just goes from A to B, and if you interrupt it anywhere along the line, the guys at the other end know immediately. Whereas most of our communications technology, encryption technology, might not survive quantum computers. Quantum computers, if they get the number of quantum bits up to a certain level, can basically solve a lot of the encryption technology that we use. Most of the present encryption technology requires factoring primes of enormous number of digits. And even with supercomputers, it takes a long time to do that. But with quantum computers, it is possible that it could be done in a matter of hours. You can't do that with quantum encryption, so it's the next level up. So it's going to be fascinating. Yes, Wesley.
Wow. That sounds like something Brookhaven would be doing. I'll have to research this. We got to come up with an answer for this. Back to you.
Yes, Brookhaven is doing it. Over.
Okay, that makes sense. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is really one of the hot aspects of practical quantum mechanics out there. They figure this one out, and the military are going to jump on it, and probably in the end it will lead to all kinds of commercial products because it's not something that has to be particularly hidden. Once it's figured out, you can open it up to the commercial industries, and there's a lot of need for encrypted lines. Right now, they're using standard encryption certificates with expirations that use prime numbers, but future industries will probably flock to this technology. You know, it's one of those odd cases where quantum mechanics is fundamentally very useful in the consumer market. Most quantum mechanics is a bit esoteric at this point. But you got to realize that 100 years ago, electromagnetism was esoteric. Good old Hertz suggested that it would never really amount to anything, our, radio waves that we love so much. Yes, Wesley recognized, but I think Ed was saying something.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Paul a quick question.
Ed, like 2H.
Yes, Ed, please ask Paul a question, and Lou recognized.
K2GJE, Paul, I knew it used to take 7 hours to talk to Voyager 2. How far out is Voyager 2 now? Over.
Oh, okay, that's, let's see, I think it was around 100, they must be up to 150 AU by now. So that gives you I think it's roughly a 39-hour trip, a round trip. The last time I looked, but I'll bring it up. I had a good website that gave you constant information on Voyager 1 and 2. So something like that. I think it's into the 39-hour area. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. Lou, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I found the link. I'm going to post it in the chat room in the next minute, dealing with this quantum photon communication thing going on at Brookhaven.
Okay, very good. And I'll probably post it during the SpaceNet report. Again, quantum encryption, very, very interesting, somewhat confusing. You sort of have to know what the present method that people break into secure communications use, and this one just kind of rips it to shreds. So it's all going to be interesting. Wesley, you wanted to say something? Wesley, I believe you checked in. Did you want to say something about this?
I have a few news from Science Field, if you don't mind, quickly.
Okay.
Okay. Scientists found how to turn break into the batteries. So very good, the warm brownish red hematite and iron oxide commonly found in rocks and soil that humans have been using as a pigment for 73,000 years. Interestingly, hematite is also used as a state-of-the-art energy storage facilities, which, with that in mind, the chemist who authorized the study develop a method to modify bricks to allow them to store electrical energy can be used to power devices. The authors brought some bricks from their local Home Depot and coated them with gas made of particle molecule. Since bricks are porous, then gas got into every nook and cranny of the bricks. When the molecule interacted with hematite in bricks, it triggered polymerization reaction, creating a polymer known as PEDOTP, which can store and conduct electricity. They knew that a chemical process worked because when they put the bricks into the oven, they came out not red, but blue. So you can actually take the original material and you can turn it into the capacitor. Using solar cell, the chemist then gave half the brick a positive charge and half of them negative charge, and connecting them with copper tape. This essentially turned the bricks into the battery, ready to store energy that can power device when a switch is flipped. Let me drop. There are some restrictions with that and some good things. So actually we could create in 13 minutes a charged battery of the lifetime about 10,000 of charges. This all is very exciting, but right now the brief can't store ton of energy. There is a scientist, Giulio D.R.C., assistant professor of chemistry of Washington University in St. Louis, who worked on the study and runs the lab where it was conducted, said 50 bricks can store amount of energy to power 3 watts of emergency lighting for 50 minutes, but that the amount of intensity of light is going to decrease over time. 3 watts is roughly equivalent of LED desk lamp. And there's a rest of articles that I'm reading right now. But they also see those bricks to be applied to purifying water development and plenty of other applications. There are good and bad things. A good thing is, yes, we have a house that's made out of bricks and we can store electricity there, turn them to heat, or and eventually, or recharge them during the day and during the nighttime, receive the energy in the house. The bad thing is that you cannot touch such a wall, because you're going to get electrocuted. Or eventually, you're going to have an unpleasant sensation. Fourth, Boston Dynamics is famous for its robots, the 70-pound quadruples, which can travel up to 3 miles for nearly 2 hours, will save Ford engineers time and money on update the world of machinery, but also update of their activity. Those clever robots can move with 3 miles per hour for about 8 hours. Let me go to that part. I don't see it here. And each one costs approximately $74,500. Boston Dynamics says that those robots will get cheaper when the production will be increased. But for that, there is a need to have a bias for it. But they already spent about $300,000 for the first series of those robots, and they are able to carry on parts and packages to the desired location. Research shows conversation quickly spreads droplets more than 6 feet inside the buildings, with implications for the transmission of diseases. COVID-19 researchers have found that ordinary conversation creates a conical jet-like airflow that quickly carries a space of tiny droplets from speaker mouth across meters of interior space. People should recognize that they have an effect around them. And that is by Dr. Howard Stone, professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering in Princeton University. Although scientists have not fully yet identified the transmission mechanism of the COVID-19 virus, current research indicated that people with symptoms could infect others through tiny droplets created when they speak, think, or laugh. So my understanding is that when you're talking, you should not speak, think, or laugh. Funny. Dr. Stone and co-lead researchers Manuk Apkarian from University of Montpellier in France wanted to learn how widely and quickly inhaled material from average speaker could spread into the space. And here's the outcome of that research. National Academy of Science, the researchers conducted that for interior activities, normal conversation, those droplets can spread in health as fast as 6 minutes, 2 meters, or about 6 feet. And that's quite dangerous.
Wesley?
There was somebody who wanted to say something.
Yeah, it was me, Wesley. It can't be 6 feet and 6 meters. It's 6 feet or 2 meters. And those studies have been around for a while. Maybe you should give me just a little chance to kind of answer what you're bringing up, okay?
Yes, I should have. I'm sorry that I didn't do it. I'm not a professional speaker, nor I was aware of it, but that's a good idea. The last thing that I'm gonna just put to the attention of the listeners, NASA European Space Agency, and we're talking about Sentinel 6. What happened to it is it landed on the asteroid and using a gas, argon, if I am not mistaken, successfully collected a lot of ground, but the cover of the compartment didn't close. So now the mechanism is losing ground, and we don't know how much of that is going to be left for to be carried on to the airbag. And to XGN, if anybody has any questions, would you please? And to XGN.
Okay, I'll assume that there's no questions. I believe Paul planned on doing a story on OSIRIS-REx as well. Just getting back to the bricks. Interesting concept, lots of problems. Basically, it's just a method to build supercapacitors. Supercapacitors already exist to a very limited degree. Electronic quartz watches basically use supercapacitors. The beauty of a supercapacitor is that it rapidly charges up, and the bad point is that it can't store a great deal of energy. Its energy density is far lower than things like lithium and other true battery technologies. And also, I don't know how much each brick is going to cost. I assume it's going to be significantly more than the usual bricks. And you'll have to worry about insulating it if it gets wet. If you put the bricks on the outside and they get wet, the capacitors will discharge, and that's going to cause a fire. So it's an interesting prototype, and I see that the prop models, and I put links up, by the way, so anyone interested in this, you can go to my link page and click on it. But it's lighting up an LED. That's not really a lot of power to light up an LED. So, you know, I don't know how big a house you would need to power a one-family type of power requirement. I don't know. Interesting, but of probably not the greatest future. But we'll see.
And two, may I interject?
Yes, please feel free, but I didn't get your entire call sign.
Call it November 2, Zulu Golf Whiskey. Name is Ray. I'm out here in Oyster Bay on a TV J-pole. Sounds right onto the back of the radio. Hopefully your sound being okay. You can illuminate a 1,000 square foot one family home. Maybe not necessarily the way you would like to, but you can have constant 24 hour a day lighting with nothing more than a two-cycle marine battery, the $150 Harbor Freight solar system with the system controller included, for about a dollar a day, and that's not necessarily even necessary. May actually get a rebate check from the power company. Back to net control. Sorry for the late check-in. Here's N2ZGW.
No, no problem, Ray. You check in when you want to check in. We don't really take regular check-ins unless people have questions or topics or comments. I think that's a kind of limited use of electricity. I don't know about you, but I want to do more in my house than just illuminate it, although that's very, very useful. So, you know, really in a real-life type of situation, you have to factor in all those other wonderful things, heaters, air conditioners, audio-visual devices, chargers, computers, and what have you. So I guess the price goes up. And the problem is that inexpensive present technology is probably much more capable of handling this than the esoteric stuff. And some of the esoteric stuff will succeed and be downsized and will be able to be produced more cheaply eventually. But in the short haul, I don't think any of that's going to happen. So I understand your comment.
Yes, going to exam.
Understood. I do have a friend, I don't recall his call sign at the moment, but he has an off-grid place up on the southern portion of the Adirondack, and has not used one single penny's worth of electricity in over 10 years. He's been off the grid, and he gets to check once in a while. That would definitely be the guy you'd like to speak to. He definitely has down to his science. You know, I see the ads on the TV for using Generac systems and solar panels, and also be advised. Let me let it drop. Whenever you see these ads on TV for the solar panel setups, with the site survey, we'll give you the solar panel setup, and you'll get money back from EIEIO every month. Don't pay too much attention to them. I've seen cases where folks have taken advantage of certain same offer, and they have put their houses up for sale, and those companies, if you read into the fine print, put into the fine print a total payoff lien on your home if you go to sell that home that you upgrade. So, be advised of that. Make sure that you have someone that's either willing to take the time to read or, go over the whole contract with the contractor you're going to afford yourself and go over that. Here's NCDW back to net.
Okay, thank you very much, Ray. Yeah, I mean, whenever you're signing things, read the small print. Take it to a lawyer. It's surprising what people hide in the small print. These technologies are interesting. Some are slightly beneficial. Some are slightly less beneficial. I understand that there are some problems occasionally with utility companies not really wanting to take consumers' excess electricity that they get through solar batteries. And of course, if someone kind of dedicates their life to living off the common utility lines, people can do that. It depends on what you want to give up and how much time you want to and effort you want to put into it. The average person, I don't think, is quite prepared to put in that much of a dedication, although, your friend apparently has and has succeeded for his plans. But, most people kind of, they don't worry about things. They don't plan things. They don't, they just go along. So I don't know. But getting back to Wesley's story about the supercapacitors, again, it's an interesting thing. My guess is that if we check on it 10 years from now, the guys looking into it decided that it wasn't going to be a profitable product and went on to come up with some other interesting idea down the road.
Yeah, I have a comment.
Sure, Wesley, comment away.
Hey, the gentleman that was talking before, he mentioned a Adirondack property, not using grid electricity. Solar panel cost for 2020. The average cost of installing electrical residential solar power system is currently $2.64 per watt. So to be